Because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Looking for a gift for a coach who loves basketball coaching? Get them a membership to basketballimmersion.com so they can join thousands of coaches who are stimulating their coaching with a world-leading platform for basketball coach education. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sign-up to get them a gift during this special time of year. Long overdue for us to have a current WNBA head coach on the podcast, and big thanks to Landrieme head coach and 2018 WNBA Coach of the Year, Nikki Collin, for joining us to share the game. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. And Coach, give us an overview. We're going to talk about defense, and we don't do it enough on the podcast, so thanks for doing this. And you were the number one ranked defense in 2018, and I believe you dropped off a little bit last year, but give us an overview of your defensive philosophy, and let's start with, what's your one pass away philosophy?
Well, I think what you're going to find, especially in the WNBA, but really when I got into being a defensive coordinator, even in college, I did a lot of studying, and I kind of settled in on kind of having two mentors defensively, and that's kind of Dick Bennett and Tom Izzo. And so I kind of used a lot of their philosophies. For us, we're a very gap-oriented team. Our league is so good in terms of one-on-one ability that we want to basically create a wall and have help on both sides. So, you know, we talk a lot about being in the gap and playing out of the gap. The minute you play into the gap in our league, you're going to give up a three. And so, you know, we're very much gap oriented in terms of one pass away.
So weight loaded on the inside foot to recover as fast as possible, or what's the emphasis? Is it matchup based in terms of certain players driving that you stay and help versus others, or dictated by your check? What is the recovery philosophy?
Yeah, I think you started right. We want to push off and get back. Certainly in our league, we're very weighted in terms of we're never going to come off a ball side shooter unless scout specific. It's someone that doesn't shoot the ball very well, and then we will. My belief, quite frankly, is that if you're going to stay in the gap and help, you better take a charge, because you just can't recover in our league one pass away on a good shooter. So, you know, we want to be there. We want to look like there's nowhere to go. But when that player, you know, hits that gap, you know, we're going to push off and recover to a shooter and really try to defensively on the ball. We really don't force any one way. I want to be square on the ball handler. And if we're going to shade any one way, it's going to be based on, you know, player tendencies, player specific.
That's great that you got into that in terms of the on the ball position. And one of the challenges of not forcing a direction is sometimes your help is not as prepared in terms of knowing where the ball is going to most likely attack. What are some things that you've done to be able to, you know, help your players one pass away in terms of that?
Well, it comes down to as simple as, you know, are you moving when the ball's in the air? I think, you know, especially it's so easy to say and harder to do. Players tend to react after a pass is made. Then your weight is going to be on the wrong foot a lot of times, one pass away. I think players, I don't care what level, and I've been at most of them from, you know, mid-major to BCS to the pros, players have tendencies. And I think people know that, you know, that, you know, I certainly have players on my team that are definitely left-handed drivers, right-handed drivers. So, you know, in our league with 12 teams and everybody understanding who everybody is, those tendencies are kind of a lot easier to coach and understand from a defensive perspective, because, you know, in college, when you're playing 10 or 12 non-conference opponents that maybe you've only played once, and that turnovers, you know, every year in terms of rosters, you know, you get a lot of the same players in our league, and certainly their games develop, but their tendencies still tend to be somewhat the same. So, you know, we're very tendency based in terms of our help.
Well, it's great. And I'm going to circle back to a defensive scout and to get into that, because it is fascinating, because players must know each other so well in that league, just having played against each other, obviously multiple times. And then obviously within certain national team programs, college, et cetera, they must know each other. So they, to a certain extent, help you prepare scout, I'm sure, too.
Yeah, and you'll sometimes play, you know, our schedule is not balanced. So, you know, we may play Indiana three times in 4 weeks, and they'll be the only three times we play them all year. We played Connecticut four times in 40 days. So by the time you're playing them for the fourth time in 40 days, and players already kind of knowing tendencies and watch a lot of the games, and, you know, we're very, very video oriented on a daily basis. So, you know, they tend to, between that and, you know, our just play system and getting them to understand those things, they do. They know each other pretty well. And certainly players in our league are good enough to counter at times, but you got to play the odds. You know, it's just the reality of basketball. You're not going to get it right every time, but, you know, if you play to player's strengths and they beat you on a counter move, you just kind of run back and try to score at the other end.
Yeah, it happens, doesn't it? It definitely mm-hmm. happens at that level more than others. And usually, you know, we start, you know, one pass away defense and on the ball defense. And then obviously at the professional level, ball screen, I would assume, is that the dominant scoring strategy of most teams at the WNBA level? It ultimately ends up in a ball screen somewhere on the floor?
Yeah, absolutely. We certainly, you know, I inherited a team 2 years ago that was 11th out of the 12 teams in the league in terms of ball screen offense and how it was utilized. We turned that around in 1 year and finished in the top three in ball screen offense because that's where our league is at. And so it's always going to start and end. You know, when you play four games in 7 days or three and five, sometimes you can't break it down and get your players to understand every play all the time. Okay, they call this play Texas, they call this play, you know, Duke, whatever, but you can certainly go into it with this is how we're guarding pin downs, this is how we're guarding ball screens, this is how we're guarding floppy action. And you kind of have to, at our level, a lot of times go back to your base, and maybe you have different philosophies with your base defense, but yeah, for us, you know, our base defense on ball screens is what we call cupping or a flat hedge. You know, we tend to fight over most screens. You just get caught rolling under too many bigs in our league. If you go under grind or if you go under fouls, you're going way under, and you kind of force that oftentimes with a switch when you do that. So for us, you know, it's always going to start with ball screen. You know, at times I've iced on the side. Especially in an overload set when you have an extra defender there and you can really ice early. And so sometimes it's game plan. Sometimes it's, hey, they're running pistol action, we're going to switch and ice any kind of pistol dribble handoff. But yeah, you know, it kind of starts with what's that base defense against ball screens. And then what are you going to do outside of that to change it up? Because you're going to see so many during a game that these players are good enough that they know the reads on everything. And if you stick with the same thing for too long, you're going to start to get beat.
On a cup or a flat hedge, what you're saying is basically it's a shallow drop coverage, right? It's not a deep drop coverage. So the player's defending Correct. The screen is closer to the point of the ball.
Correct. Absolutely. And so, you know, we really want to get into the ball handler, shove them off the screen. We basically tell our posts we don't ever want their player to roll behind them. So they're, you know, they're in that constant drop mode, but they're, how high they are, how deep or shallow they are is oftentimes going to be dependent on, you know, the offensive guard coming off that screen. You know, if it's Taurasi, we'll say we need a higher cup. You know, if it's a driver coming off the screen, you know, we may drop a little bit more so it's easier to get back to a rolling post. So a lot of times that drop is dictated by the offensive player, the guard coming off the ball screen.
Yeah, great stuff. Great information. You kind of mentioned it previously that trapping was actually a very efficient thing for your team this year in terms of, I assume, the analytics?
The analytics, for sure. I mean, we were early in the season, it was definitely our best. We were the best in the league in trapping ball screens, and our volume wasn't high, but, you know, it was really effective when we would do it. We tended to start trapping, you know, in our league, and I know it's changed in college too, but with a 14-second, you know, reset or a 14-second side out situation, we always trap side outs. A lot of teams will zipper up and run a high ball screen. And so it's kind of one of those instances where you've got your team set already. You know, you know who's one pass away, you know who's going to have to rotate to a popping post, or, you know, who's going to have to help absorb the role and play out. And so we trapped a lot on side outs, and then we started to do it play specific. So if we knew a team ran, for instance, LA ran a ton early in the year of zippering Chelsea Gray to the top, runner into a ball screen, then we were trapping and trying to get the ball out of Chelsea Gray's hands.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, again, like a lot of the philosophy nowadays is to not trap, and most aggressive defenses in ball screen coverage tend to play out that the analytics are worse. And but it speaks to the differences. I mean, there's differences for teams, there's differences for leagues, all these different things. But am I wrong that there appears to be, from watching games, especially on Synergy as preparing for this, is there less switching as a whole in the WNBA than maybe is trending elsewhere in the game?
I would say. And some of that is, you know, our league is still, as much as you take Washington, for instance, who can play big lineups and can switch a lot and won a WNBA championship this year, and they look a lot like an NBA roster in that they have moving parts. They have, you know, fours and fives that can stretch you to the arc. Big guards, you know, like a Natasha Cloud, that can switch even if she's guarding the point guard. And so you certainly have some of that, but you also have more traditional low post players in a Sylvia Fowles or a Brittany Griner or a Liz Cambage, where you just don't want to switch unless you're going to switch in necessity. And I think that, so you probably see less of it. You know, it doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of fours in this league that you can get away with switching. Most teams in our league will 3-4 switch any ball screens. You know, that it just gives you that one advantage of, hey, that's a position we're not constantly, you know, having to show and rotate and be in help side. Because I think any good defense, and if there's one thing that, you know, especially in this league, that is a personal philosophy of mine, is you don't want to have to be in rotation. The more you can keep the matchups the way you want them, with your better defenders on the better offensive players, the more you can keep players home and out of rotations, you know, you're going to get beat in our league if you're constantly in two-on-ones on the backside. So if you have to trap low post players, if you end up, you know, trapping ball screens too much and teams are always playing out to numbers advantage, you can get away with that more in college than you can in our league.
Yeah, it's just more players that can hurt you when you make, when you're in rotation, I imagine, in that sense. But so looking at the weak side coverage, do you X out, or do you try and stay with your check in terms of closeouts? What's the emphasis there in terms of covering two-on-ones when they happen?
Yeah, we're going to X out. We take the approach of basket next anytime we're in rotation. So if we're trapping a low post, if we're doubling a ball screen, we have two terminologies. We trap in triangle, depending on when there's at. So the idea of there are two people on the ball and we're going to triangle the lane outside of that. But also, you know, if we're going to double, we like the concept of basket next. So we're always, you know, protecting the rim and playing out. And so we will definitely X out. We'll X out oftentimes, even on cross screening action, where we want to stay in a bump longer. You know, we're going to take our weak side defender and have them X out and take the player coming to the top in a screen, the screener action, anything like that. But yeah, we'll play pretty traditional X out on a baseline drive, drift action. So we just prefer not to be in rotations. And quite frankly, you know, when we were number one in defensive rating 2 years ago, so much of it was we defended the ball really well, but we also had posts that could really move in rotations. And so that was a big part of our success.
And alluding to some of these things, then, how has your defense adapted to analytics? And maybe these are two questions, and the increase in three-point attempts. So yeah, maybe let's start with the analytics first.
Yeah, I think analytics are such a good tool. I mean, I will say this. I think defense is an interesting thing when it comes to the analytics. Like, to me, there's still so much of an eye test. And, you know, watching for feedback, because if I look at a certain player's defensive rating, you know, there are so many factors that go into a defensive rating in terms of who are they on the court with? And are they the person, you know, I may have a point guard that's not a great defender, but if she's surrounded by four really good defenders that can cover in ball screens that, you know, protect her when that player beats her off the bounce. You know, we were number one in blocks 2 years ago. We blocked a lot of shots. Now it hurt our defensive rebounding efficiency because we are coming to block, you know? So then all of a sudden, are we mismatched on the backside on a rebound? So I don't put much into defensive ratings. There are players in our league that I think are defenders and they'll have good defensive ratings. So for us, from a defensive perspective, the way we utilize analytics is really more offensively based. So we want to look at when we're playing an opponent. We use it for scouting in terms of how does a team score, the percentage of points in the paint. Are they a team that makes threes in the corner? What does it mean for Phoenix? They score more than 30 points a game from the arc. They win, you know, 9 out of 10 games. So we basically factor in more offensive analytics into how we guard people and say, okay, this is a game that we're willing. I'm not a big believer in the flyby on a contest.
I was going to ask you about that.
It's not, I'm trying as the more NBA I watch, the more I want to embrace it. But then the old school side of me says, you know, I want a clean contest, you know, not leave your feet. You know, they tend to be high risk, high reward. We certainly want to send people to a mid-range jump shot if we can. But, you know, that hasn't been, you know, my personal philosophy. And I'm trying to watch more. I'm kind of an NBA geek in terms of, you know, watching what they're doing and why they're doing it. But it's very much a, this is a game we've absolutely got to run them off the three-point line. We cannot close out short. You know, Breann January is going to make corner threes. We just can't give her corner threes. And so, you know, we almost use analytics more on the defensive side from scouting and how teams score and where they score.
Well, as you said, like the analytics, they can obviously be part of the story, not the whole story, but it's fascinating. And I don't know how much you know about some of the analytics because I'm certainly learning them as we go, but even some of the analytics around the same hand contesting stats, some of them suggest, again, like it's a significant reduction in percentage when we contest, say, a right-handed shooter with our left hand versus the wrong hand or obviously not challenged at all. And like, I'm just thinking about that going, okay, that's obviously something probably you emphasized anyways as a coach, but do you use the stats then to support it? And then how do you track things like that? And do you track those things in such a short season?
I think that's the tough part. There's the biggest part of where we can take analytics and they can matter and they can help us. And yet we can't go overboard with them because, you know, I might have a 2.5 week training camp and I'll play typically 3 preseason games in there and I have to take days off. You know, we tend to go 3 days on, 1 day off in that stretch. And so sometimes we'll play a preseason game after 4 practices and, you know, I'll have 2 or 3 players that aren't back from overseas yet. And so I just want them to be able to guard a flare screen, guard a pin down, you know, really understand what we do and why we do it. And so some of the intricacies that are available, you know, even at our level, as much as I think we're a team that relies on them, I've got a staff that's really good with them. My assistant, Mike Peterson, did some advanced scouting in the NBA and is kind of an analytical nerd. So we study them. But I think that the implementation of the idea of which hand we're contesting with, you know, is probably farther than we can go, just in terms of the amount of practice time, the amount, you know, that we're trying to even build off of in a 34 game, you know, regular season schedule. So, you know, we're going to look at them and we're going to figure out what we can implement and how. And, you know, for us, it may be bigger picture sometimes more than that type of small, you know, difference, which, you know, may make a huge difference, but it's hard. I think it's hard to spend time on implementing that.
No, it's such a great point. I mean, the NBA is the ideal situation just because of depth of staff and obviously the number of games played and all the different things that they have in terms of those things. And again, from high school to college to WNBA, I mean, seasons are just shorter and, you know, different things that go with that. But I'm wondering, based on the big picture, how do you decide what defense to play? You said it goes back a little bit to your mentors and who you've studied, but somewhat at the WNBA, is it reverse engineered based on what opponents and offensive trends are, or is it predicated more based on your team and your personnel?
Okay, so it's some of both. So that's a great question. I think, you know, for me, I have having been basically in the position where I got to be a defensive coordinator in college and really put in a defensive philosophy and build it from scratch in terms of what we do day to day in a practice setting compared to what we do in scouting, and then kind of transitioning that as an assistant coach and having that same role when I was in Connecticut and feeling the trends, you know, and understanding that, you know, there were times that one of the great things about when I was an assistant working with Kurt Miller in Connecticut is that we had the kind of relationship where he let me make those calls in terms of, well, how are we going to guard horns in this game? You know, are we going to three-way switch it? You know, are we going to jam it? Are we going to, you know, and we all have our own like personal philosophies about what works, but you also are basing it off of how do they score out of it? You know, so you can have a philosophy, but where one team may score out of the high-low action, you know, 90% of the time when they're running horns, that's what they're trying to get to. Or they're just trying to weak swing it into two-man action on the backside. You know, like what is a team trying to do and why are they trying to do it? And the one thing about coaches, not unlike player tendencies, is coaches have the same tendencies and they may put in new plays each year and they may, you know, look at what's going on in the NBA and these are great sets for our personnel. They still have tendencies, you know. Cheryl Reeve, when she had Maya Moore and Simone Augustus, was going to come back to a pin down screen if they needed a basket, you know, and if the pin down wasn't there, they were going to force feed to Sylvia. And so you kind of start to understand at our level, like what coaches' tendencies are too. And so you have to know, like, what are we going to do? You know, you have to be on the nail, right? I mean, it's such a huge in the NBA and the WNBA, having someone at the nail is so, so important. But what about when teams are really good at screening the nail, you know, and flare screening the nail? And so, you know, you have to understand what the trends are so that you're capable of making those adjustments. And so it's a little bit of both. Like, I definitely have a base philosophy on how we're going to guard a flare and how we're going to guard a pin down, but, you know, we're going to have to top block certain players in our league. So, well, I don't want to take us out of help side by having to top block the pin down. There's times when top blocking the pin down is the best thing I can do to help my team not get beat on that possession. Make them play to the pinch then and make them play, you know, with that two-man action with the one in the five or the one in four instead of, you know, it being the big guard kind of in that situation. So it's very much trends related, but it also, for me, there's a comfort in my players understanding, hey, they just put a new set in, but we know how to guard a pin down. We know how to guard a flare screen. We know, you know, and this is how we do it so that when you come out of an ATO, you know, that regardless of what's been drawn up, that you understand at your core what you're going to do.
Solve one problem, create another, right? I mean, that's the challenge, obviously, coaching against really good players from a nightly basis. I'm curious if there's something defensively that you rank low for that is intentional. For example, you don't force a lot of turnovers because you tend to play, obviously, in the gap more, but obviously you talk about top-logging a lot. Is there something like that that shines through in terms of the philosophy?
Well, I think there are times when I don't like to not be good at anything. In fact, the thing that drives me crazy about us, and it was a huge issue for us this past year and why we weren't as good, I think, defensively, our field goal percentage defense was still good, but we just gave up way too many offensive rebounds. And a lot of that is, you know, when you lose a player like Angel McCautry, who's a multi defensive, all defensive team player. A lot of it was, you know, she cleaned up the defensive boards when we had to rotate. You know, when we put our posts in rotation, she was big and strong and dominated at times on the defensive board, regardless of who was down there. We just played small all year, you know, and so we knew that was going to be an Achilles heel for us. And it was, you know, we just gave up too many offensive rebounds. And even though our field goal percentage defense was good, there were too many possessions, you know, or we would foul on the backside, you know, trying to battle for a rebound. And so, you know, for us, if there's that's one thing about having active posts that like to block shots is you're going to at times block some shots. And at times the ball is going to go up on the rim. Because they're going to be worried about the shot blocker, you know, and we've got to do a better job of cleaning up the backside. So a lot of what we do is predicated on our own personnel and we really couldn't switch nearly as many actions this past year. We rarely played big at the three, so we couldn't 3-4 switch ball screens. We wanted to create more turnovers. I actually believe that at times you can create more turnovers in a gap-oriented defense than you can in, say, a one-pass-away denial defense because, you know, if a player is being denied, you're not going to throw it, you know. But if you're really good in your gap integrity and you can shoot the gap, you know, so we want to, with our athleticism, be able to create more turnovers. But yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, when you look at our league and you look at a team like Seattle, who led the league in turnovers, they were a high risk, high reward defense. You know, they were an ice team and they rotated. They didn't stunt. They full rotated all the time and made you play to 2-on-1s. And at times that's, so their field goal percentage defense wasn't very good, but they created offense off their defense. And so you kind of have to, you know, pick your poison in that way. And my philosophy is more, I'm more conservative. Let's keep people in front of us. Let's keep a good defender on a good offensive player. So we aren't naturally going to create more turnovers than some teams because of our defensive philosophy.
I love the term gap integrity. That's a great one for teams that play that way. That's great. Coach, if you look at one defensive stat, what would it be if you could look at only one?
Yeah, points per possession. I mean, I think that's the obvious one. You know, we talked to our team a lot about, even when I took the job, about how we're never going to measure ourselves on points per game. Because if, you know, if we're talking to them about wanting to be in the top three in the league in offensive pace, then you're going to create more possessions. You don't want to go off defensive points per game. So, you know, for the most part, you're going to look at points per possession and how low can you drive that? Can you drive it, you know, lower than 1 point per possession, you're going to be a really, really good team. You know, 2 years ago when we finished second in the league, we were the asterisk of the league. And I say that because if you looked at the top six teams in the league, they were the best offensive teams in the league. You know, they were the teams that shot the most threes, the highest percentage of threes. You know, they were the offensive analytic monsters that we're so used to talking about, the threes, the layups, the less mid-range. You know, and we were the asterisk in that because we had so much success, and it was because we were the number one defensive team in the league. And so teams had a hard time scoring against us, and we found ways to grind out wins late when we needed to in close games. And so, you know, we don't want to always look like that. While I always care about defense, I tell people all the time that, you know, I care about defense because I got the opportunity to, I had a head coach say, hey, I want you to be my defensive coordinator. So I wanted to be good at it, you know, so I studied it and figured out what I wanted my philosophy to be, and then gained a lot of confidence in that area. Having said that, you know, I don't want to be the asterisk. I want to be great defensively and always hang our hat on our ability to get stops. But, you know, we want to be a good offensive team. And 2 years ago, when we had the great season, while we were bad offensively in the first half, we were top four in the league in the second half offensively as well. And that's why we went 15-2 in our last 17, because our defense stayed consistent, but we were better offensively. So we gave ourselves a chance to win different kinds of games rather than grind it out. Now, having said that, I still have the mentality when I'm on the sideline, if I'm in a game in the 70s in our league and we're in a one possession game, I'm not nervous at all. I'm not saying I know we're going to win every game, but I have so much comfort in those type of games. When we played Vegas 2 years ago and we were in one of those 10, I think we beat them like 107, 102. That's just uncomfortable for me. When I feel like we can't get stops and it's going to take us kind of keeping pace offensively, that's when as a coach, I still get nervous.
And I'm guessing it plays out in WNBA the same way in the NBA. Like, to win a championship, you need, what is it, a top five of both? I think in the NBA, they say a top 10 in both, but size of your league, probably a top five in both, offense and defense.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, Washington this year set every record there is in offensive analytics and statistics for a team over a season. And so they were the best offensive team in the league all year. But why they won the championship was because they were much better defensively from 2018 to 2019. They found a way to figure out how to, you know, there was at times in the championship series with Connecticut where it really was a shootout and both teams were really good offensively. But oftentimes it comes down to getting stops in late game situations. And so their length and how they played, I think, was enough for them to get over the hump.
Is there an analytics stat or is there something, how do you define effort best on defense for your players?
I think when you look at stats, I'm not a big, certainly we have players that block shots or get steals, but for me, so often it's, you know, effort stats are eye test stats. They're, you know, the stats that when you look back and you're watching the film, I'm a big believer in film work. We watch a ton of it, but, you know, in small doses. And so, you know, so often those are the clips you're going to pull to show this is what I want it to look like all the time. When you see five people kind of moving in harmony with synergy, you know, a loose ball type of play, a charge, you know, we don't take enough charges, quite frankly. And I think it's much harder in the WNBA to take charges just because of the charge arc and the rules on the gather. And it just, it's harder to take charges in our league than it is in college. But, you know, so much of it is seeing it, feeling it. You know, I'm a big believer that the best fans in our game understand hustle plays and they understand how much that means to a game and how much momentum is created when you don't just cheer, you know, on a made basket, but you cheer because someone lays out for a ball. Those are the kind of things that we're going to see and show. And so often it's not one player. It's when, you know, you truly see this synergy between five players.
So when you sit down with a player then based on effort or based on technique or tactics or something like that, what are some simple things or what are some things that every player can do to improve their defense? Is there a common theme that comes through when you're working with, a new player in the league to be able to help them improve their defense?
Yeah, I think it starts, I think you have to see it on film. I mean, I'm a firm believer that, you know, we certainly get rookies in our league that have had great coaching, but, you know, maybe they were a pressing 2-3 half court team and you're just not going to see 2-3 in our league with defensive 3 seconds. And so, you know, so often it's seeing it. It's defense is so much about being proactive, really moving when the ball's in the air. It's about understanding what teams do and why they do it. Because, you know, otherwise, if you're not prepared to get around the screen before it comes, you know, Sylvia Fowles is going to blow you up. And so, you know, a lot of it is certainly it's starting and it's really breaking down technique. And I'm still a big believer in 4-player shell drill or even 2-player shell drill at times in terms of ball screen defense and really repping it and getting them to understand the footwork, the angles, how to drive a top foot over a screen while still not getting rejected. That's kind of one of my number one rules. We're not going to get the way we play ball screen defense. You are not allowed to get rejected on a ball screen. And so that's like a big part of our DNA in terms of them really understanding what it means. Like, I want to be aggressive and go over to the top of screens, but you've got to do it the right way or you will get rejected. And so a lot of it is you teach the footwork and then you show it in film and you're not ready right here. You know, you're standing up. So you can't, you know, low man wins. I don't care what sport, what time, you know, being ready to get around a pin down, being ready to be in rotation, being at the nail and playing out rather than reacting to the nail late, you know, makes a huge difference.
I love that rejecting thing. That was a non-negotiable in my philosophy that everyone in the gym was allowed to lose their mind when someone got rejected on a ball screen in practice.
Just amen that
was,
to that.
That was a non-negotiable and tremendous. And coach, maybe you've talked about video and you've talked about the importance of that. Can you talk us through a little bit of what you would do in individual player development with video in terms of helping them improve their defense? Are there multiple clips? Are there specific clips just that are focused on defense? Are you adding stats and analytics to that? What are we doing in terms of that?
No, but I will tell you a fun story. So my first year in the league, I was talking to a player who I thought could be a better defender than she was. And, you know, I didn't think particularly engaged. And, you know, I remember talking to her after practice one day and saying, you know, like, we just can't have this player go off again. You're too good for this. You know that your defensive rating is 11th out of the 12 players on our team. And she looked at me and she said, "Do you believe that?" And I said, "Yeah, actually right now I do." You know, and the amazing thing was she turned around and shut that player down in the next game. And it was the difference between winning and losing. And so while I don't put tons and tons of value in quote defensive rating, you know, in that situation, it was, you know, it was a tool to say, hey, do you really think this is where you should be? You know, but I think, you know, when we watch video with a player, we're going to clip probably five or six. It's amazing how long really breaking down five good possessions can go, how long that can take. Because when you're watching 30 seconds and you're clicking your space bar, you know, every other second to show them, okay, here, you know, your positioning here, you know, you're not ready to get screened here. So much of it is showing them the possession and how it starts and how it finishes, so that they understand, you know, there are always, you know, I've always said, like, I have a personal philosophy and we don't want to shoot gaps when we're in floppy actions, and we want, you know, but I've also told them, hey, you know, if you choose to shoot a gap and you don't give up a shot, you know what? I'm not going to get mad about it. Cause sometimes the best way to get from A to B is the way you went, you know, just understand if you read wrong and they bump that back, you know, I don't have anyone that can help you. You know, but I can help you on the curl. And so sometimes it's instincts and getting them to understand, because, you know, there are players that truly do see the game in shades of gray, and there are players that just don't. They're black and white. Tell me how to do it. You know, so you for those players, you've got to, like, break down the rules and get them to see that they're not where they're supposed to be. And if they were where they were supposed to be, how we guard things would work a lot better. And so, you know, it's a lot of that. It's four or five possessions. The reality is no one likes to see themselves fail, but sometimes, you know, for growth, they have to see it. But if they see too much of it, then all of a sudden they walk away with a negative feeling rather than here's how I grow and get better from this.
I love giving them freedom of decision-making possibilities or solutions to figure out on their own. But again, it's within a template of what you feel for your system and what you feel for your philosophy. So it's such a great point that you made. And I love the story too. So maybe can you walk us through an example of how you would defensive game plan for a game? You study the opposing analytics and then you game plan accordingly. You've talked about that, but you've also talked about the uniqueness of each team and the prep. So what goes into a defensive game plan for you and your team?
Yeah, I think it depends on, you know, sometimes it can be broken by, some teams are very set oriented, obviously. Some teams are ultimately, you know, for instance, I'll use Washington as an example. They certainly have a lot of different offenses, a lot of different sets, and they are also probably the best in the league at disguising their play calls, you know, so you're not sitting on the next action. So you can't always look at them and say, unless they call four up, you know, then you kind of know where they're going. But, you know, they're a team that ultimately it'll come down to how are we going to guard Christy Tolliver and Elena Deladon in two-man action with three away? And maybe they're flaring and maybe they're staggering and maybe they're just spacing with three away. But what are we going to do in two-man ball screen actions? You know, are we going to switch and get size? Are we going to, you know, so a lot of it will be start with predicated on, okay, here's what, like, for instance, my staff will give me, we like to call it the menu. And so certainly everybody runs a lot of the same sets, but I'll get a menu every game from my staff in terms of here's what they run the most percentage of the time. You know, here are the side outs, here are the, you know, and you get to where there's obviously a language of the W, there's a language in the NBA. And so, you know, we're going to start with looking at what they run and why they run it. And then we're going to take the analytics of this is how many percentage of points that come in the paint. You know, this is a team that makes predominantly corner threes, you know, and then so it's two pronged, you know, it's where do they score and how, and then what are we going to do to take away one or two of those things and be okay with something else. You know, like when we play Phoenix, we tend to not double. Like people think we're crazy to not double Griner. I'm comfortable with her getting 40 as long as we don't give up threes, you know? And so you kind of have to go based off, and that's where we utilize analytics, because we looked at Phoenix and said, okay, they're 7-2 and they make 8 or more threes a game. We've got to take the 3-point shot away. And we didn't beat them, but we gave ourselves a chance to win with a last possession and the ball with a shot to win the game. And so, you know, your goal is to always put your team in position to win a game. And so those are kind of the key components as we take player tendencies, add to it, play tendencies, and then it might just be actions. And this is how we're going to guard Deladon in this game, or this is how we're going to guard two-man actions in this game. And so that's kind of how we break it down. And I'm just a big believer. I'm getting that menu from my staff. I'm watching it, getting, you know, comfort with sets, where they're scoring, how they're scoring, the important analytics going into that game. And then we'll meet an hour and a half before practice and, you know, rewatch the film together that we're going to show the team, so that I'm up there in front saying, okay, this is what they're running. Here's how we're guarding it. Here's what we're doing with horns. And sometimes we try to even break it down to, we might give the players a simple menu where we'll put even up on the dry erase board while we're watching film. This is the key thing. Two-man action in the middle of the floor, we're doing this. Two-man action on the side, we're doing this. Horns, we're doing this. Pin downs, this is how we're guarding. Game plan, period. You know, like sometimes that is, it can come down to that more than it can come down to, hey, they're going to zipper into a lot of actions. They're going to run a lot of high floppy. They're going to run, you know, whatever it is. Sometimes it's much easier to even break it down to like four things that if they walk away and that's all they remember, then we've got a shot to be good defensively.
Yeah, no, it's such a good point in terms of that and their understanding. And also the point about one player, like you have to decide somewhat on defense in the ideal world, how they're going to beat you, right? Like, you know, if you're not going to double Sylvia Fowles, she's going to score. Well, okay, that's on me as the head coach.
Right.
But, you know, if she kicks out for an open three, then that's on you as a team. So it's such a great example to be able to drive that.
Well, and I can tell you another, you know, it's interesting. Like I'll use like Alyssa Thomas, when I coached her, such a strong, good defender, a very smart, high IQ basketball player, you know, but it was interesting because one of my strengths is that I have almost like a photographic memory in terms of as the game action is going along, you know, if we were to come to a break in action, I can probably tell you on the last three possessions, they scored on floppy and they hit a three, you know, they scored off the pinch action. And, you know, like I have that mentality and that, you know, it's just been kind of something I've always had. And so, you know, when I was an assistant in Connecticut and we would play LA and, you know, in their championship season and we're in a competitive game and it's early in the game. And I feel like I know how I want to guard their two-man ball screening continuity, you know, and we come to a timeout and AT's going, coach, like they're killing us on the ball screen, you know? And in my mind, I'm going, okay, NECA just had a contested pull-up jump shot off a pick and pop, you know, that we got to contest on. And the two possessions before that, they scored, you know, 2-on-1 in transition off a turnover. And, you know, so in my mind, but a big part of our league that's very different than college is in a lot of ways, this having open dialogue with players, you know, and having them understand why you do what you do and why you would make adjustments accordingly. And so, you know, I'm looking at her saying, well, how would you prefer to guard it? Because I think the problem is not our ball screen coverage. It's that we haven't necessarily executed our game plan yet to go away from it. You know, so sometimes there's, do we have the right game plan? Maybe we don't. Maybe we need to adjust. Well, other times it's like, we actually have to execute the game plan we put in. You know, if we're not actually guarding it the way we talked about guarding it, then we don't know whether we should change up what we're doing. And so there's that philosophy as well. And you may change in a particular game and against a particular opponent, what you want to do. And so, you know, for instance, going back to Connecticut, and we were playing Phoenix. We'd beaten Phoenix, and we singled up Griner in the game that we beat him. We came back and played him 3 weeks later, you know, and I'm discussing how we need to double and rotate out of the double. And they're asking me the question, well, why are we doubling? We just beat them. We played them one-on-one, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, but here's the difference. When we played them the last time, Griner was averaging 18 touches on the low block a game. Okay. Since we played them over the last five games, she's averaging 35 touches a game on the low block. And so you can't play her one-on-one 35 times. We're not going to double her every time, but this is the difference between how a team was playing 3 weeks ago and how they're playing now. Like, they are making a concerted effort to throw the ball to the low block on every offensive possession, you know? So you have to then adjust your game plans, even when your game plans have worked in the past, you know? And if you don't work on that double team, you're not going to want to do it in the game, because you want to, your players, you have to give confidence in their ability to be successful doing something, you know? And if you don't practice it the first time you do it in a game because you need to make an adjustment and it doesn't work, they're going to look at you and go, that didn't work, you know? So you have to rep things that you're going to utilize.
Such a great example and great story to be able to illustrate, obviously, the importance of adding some type of stats or some type of credibility to your words, and just makes it more powerful, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's what this game is about. It's about when you're playing against the best players in the world all the time, they're too good to just think that you're going to do the same thing all the time. And the coaches are too good. And so you have to be willing to use what's at your disposal. And that's the beauty of the analytics you get, you know, and truly understanding, like, okay, we aren't going to guard Tierra Ruffin Pratt, but hey, you guys, like, yeah, she's a career 20% 3-point field goal percentage from three. She's already hit four. You know, at some point you're going to have to guard her because today's her day, you know? And while the game plan was to help off of her, you know, how long are you going to help off of her before you realize that we're going to get beat because right now she's Steph Curry. And so even being able for players to sometimes make that transition without being told, you know, and that is one of the differences in our league is players, because they know these players, because they've done it longer, because they're older and more mature, you know, you want them to believe in the game plan, but there's also a time and place for them to just make a play. You know, here's where I just go make a play.
Love it. Love it. Coach, tremendous stuff. Tremendous. I love the stories that support what you said. Obviously, the analytics and the insights and just the depth of understanding of defense at your level and certainly in terms of your philosophy. So just thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Well, absolutely. I'm sure there's a lot of people that prefer offense and, you know, but maybe they learned a little something today. So this was awesome. I appreciate the time.
Well, it sounds like both of us prefer offense too, Coach.
Absolutely.
But we won't tell anyone.
Exactly.
Love it. Thank you. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.